brain cells and support systems in specific architecture. They're located in specific places, and each cell kind of has a sense of where they are and what they should be, and stem cells will form into final form of those brain cells. And how the brain cells are organized and the fibers are implemented produce a lot of kind of hard-coded behavioral situations. If you take some animals and you raise them alone by themselves, they will demonstrate behaviors that are common for their species. So there are some things that are just wired into our neural network. Other things are partially trainable. So they might have a primitive aspect of a behavior, but only in the setting of other people, other animals that they can see, do they kind of fine-tune it to a slightly different purpose that they weren't particularly evolved to. So why we have the kind of behavioral aspects that we do, that's another mystery to be learned from future research into neurophysiology, and probably well worth a few dozen Nobel Prizes.
Thank you very much for that, Dr. Roy. So talking about more advanced creatures, animals, that belong to the same group as pigs, human beings. Of course, there are the differences, but mammals, there is a group that pigs and humans belong to. But talking about the how many researchers we have per million. In United States in 2017, there was 23.5%. Actually, USA contributed. USA contributed 16.2% in 2017, but so European Union, 23.5% of researchers. China, that was 21.1% of the researchers. So, are we talking about the brain power? Are we talking about limitations or condition in given parts of the world? What actually makes us to be less than in 1996, where that number was twice as much? Dr. Roy.
I don't know. It could be that the fields of interest have changed over the years. It could be supply. It could be demand. Unfortunately, science isn't like laying bricks. If you throw a lot of money at it, you improve chances, but you don't guarantee. If you throw enough money at bricklayers, you'll have a building. There's no and or buts. But in the case of science, it's not 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5. It's all over the place. You have to have fits of creativity. You have to think up clever experiments that allow you to do things that up until that point were not technically possible. And it's a moving target. So, what would be easy to reproduce today would be impossible to reproduce 100 years ago with all the money in the world. So it's not a simple thing, unfortunately. It would be easier, and life would be that simple.
Yeah, it was a purpose in it. I mentioned the number of researchers in United States versus other parts of the world. The Nobel Prize is something that makes more visible discovery to the world and to the audience because of its role. But those researchers were working on roundworms. The species of millimeter size. So the discovery of microRNA, for discovery of the microRNA that was a worm that was used as a species, it's called Caen or Habitat elegans. So how far did we go from the simple organism to the form of human animal that we are today? Dr. Roy.
Well, the point is that there are some control methods that are so ancient and so necessary in the first place that you don't have to search for them in higher life forms that just evolved in the last few million years. You can go way, way back to this lovely little worm. Because a lot of these, I won't say simple because it ain't simple, but the determining control mechanics, once you figure it out for the first species, you just keep on using it because it keeps on working. So, you know, if it ain't broke, you don't fix it. So a lot of stuff that you see in quite relatively newly evolved subspecies use the same mechanism as their ancient ancestors. You take a look at a chloroplast, and the chlorophyll is chlorophyll. There's no real reason. There's two types of chlorophyll, just to complicate things, but there's only two. So there's no real reason for a third. So no plant life took the trouble to evolve it. So it's not that amazing at this point. You try and find the simplest life form. It's inexpensive and easy to keep that you believe uses the same mechanisms that you're investigating. You know, it's a lot easier to work on a worm than to work on a chimpanzee. Chimpanzee will rip your face off. The worm won't.
Okay, and that actually drives us to some sort of summary. And the question is, how much do we have left? So we as a species, as a human beings, we are on the planet Earth. But at the same time, what are we doing with this planet Earth? Population of mammals, birds, fish, reptiles, and amphibians have an average decline in size by 60% in just over 40 years. So 60% of everything around us we damaged, we killed as a human species. The biggest drives of current biodiversity loss are over exploration and agriculture, for both linked to human consumption that is increasing and increasing and increasing. So how much do we have left before we damage all of it, before we overpopulate as a species planet Earth? So we're talking about the climate change that is partially caused by human beings. I would love Dr. Roy to say a few words about it. Thank you.
Okay, I think climate change is bad. I think people tend to be exploitive. You could get an argument by saying that we're overgrown population-wise. China is getting depopulated. They've lost millions over the years because their replacement is down to, I think, 1.3 or 1.38. So, you know, they have 1.38 children in each generation. You kind of need two to at least for replacement purposes. So there are countries that are getting depopulated. I think Russia is going to have a population problem as well as China. I think India isn't. They're going to have a population problem in the other direction. They just keep on having babies in Pakistan and such. So there are countries where the population is growing, and there's others where the population is shrinking and collapsing in on itself. So like most things, it's very, very complicated. Will we actually do what is necessary for climate change? I don't know. Human beings tend to be highly irrational, unfortunately. So once you put that into the equation, they may decide to just kind of make a prayer dance to the spaghetti god in the sky to save them and do absolutely nothing else. I don't know. As it may sound, I'm not terribly optimistic tonight.
In our age, we not worry about ourselves, but we maybe worry about our children and our grandchildren or grandchildren of the grandchildren. And we lost 60% everything around us for 4 years. How much is going to be left after next 4 years? So human animal tend to take the pleasure of being more advanced than other animals around. Kill for pleasure for me, but not for others. For others not, but for me, people who kill other animals for pleasure are barbarians. But that's me. I mean, going and hunting for pleasure, to see a blood, to see something suffering that is as animal as you are. I have no words. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy.
Okay, for the sake of a few hunters out there, there are population-controlled hunting seasons and times where in certain areas, if you don't cull the animals, it produces secondary consequences. So if there's a viable population of animals that can be slightly weeded out with hunting season, a lot of people like to hunt. They put the things up on the wall. I don't know why. They cut the meat up and they eat it, what have you. So hunters, to me, there's some hunters that I completely understand what's going on with them. The ones who kind of skirt the laws, they go out there. They basically have a bazooka, and there's no challenge and there's no effort. They just paid a guy enough money to basically staple an animal in front of them so that they can kill him. Well, then those guys have mental problems. But hunters out there, there are some legitimate rational hunters out there. But I don't know, all things in moderation, usually in places that license people to hunt, they are limited in the kill rate. They can't just kind of decimate the place. So as long as things are a little bit rational, I'm kind of okay with that, I guess. I couldn't do it myself. I couldn't kill an animal. I can kill a bug, but I can't kill an animal. Anyway, anyone with any closing comments before we turn the page? Okay, I will take that as a no thank you. So, once again, thanks to everyone for their participation tonight. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned a few things. And I hope you'll join us next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. But it is now 10:18 and perfect time for Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet Report.
Thanks, Roy. ATTGS, WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. And great topics tonight. Very interesting. And, I just wanted to lead off with a couple of short stories, like the crew number eight that was sent up to the International Space Station 6 months ago. But, all right, they should have been back already. It's a crew of four people. They went up on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. But due to the weather, well, starting with the hurricanes down in Florida and some additional bad weather recently, they are going to probably return maybe in about 4 or 5 days instead of like last week. But you have four people on board. One is a Russian. Then you have NASA astronauts, Barrett and Dominic, and also a woman, Jeanette Epps. By the way, I looked up her call sign, KF5QNU. So she made a whole bunch of school contacts when she was up there. I'm not sure about the other fellows, but they'll be coming back. You know, it's a problem lately. You have the other two that are going to be stuck up there till February. Sonny Williams, who again, she's a Hammond, and her co-traveler, which, you know, there'll be one more. There'll be Bruce, one more. They'll be coming back in February with the SpaceX crew, the Dragon that's now attached to the space station. That one went up with two people, and it'll be coming back with four. And after that, they'll be back to the normal sequence. You know, four up, four down, and that's where they do it. They basically bring up four first, and then when they're on board for about a week or two, the other crew usually returns. So let me drop it. Now, appearing in the sky for the last couple of days, I haven't seen it yet, is a comet. And it's a little over 40 million miles away. Near the And I haven't seen pictures of it. And as it, as you get to dusk and, you know, beyond dusk, you can see this comet if you have a good view of the horizon. But 2 days ago, it was around 4 degrees, and then I believe yesterday was 8, it should be about 10 or 12 today, degrees above the horizon. But each day that goes by, it's getting a little lighter, and we can't see it, that's good. I heard you do need a pair of binoculars. Dave got his call, but he sent me an email. He did use binoculars to see it. So, yeah, interesting. I don't have a good westerly view. I have trees and houses, you know. For me, it's got to be above, like, 20 degrees for me to see it. And I should be able to do that by the 19th. The 19th would be the last day. And then at that point, it would be around 30 degrees above the horizon. So I should be able to see it then if I go out with a pair of binoculars. But it was discovered only, a year ago in China, and also South African observatory already, they noticed this comet coming. So we'll see. But not to give up, there's another one coming. And that one, that new one will be here on, they said the 23rd. And from what I read, it should be very bright. It should be a magnitude minus 8 or minus 8.3, they wrote it up as, which is a very bright object in the sky. To give you an idea, I could see the space station, when you have a minus 2 or minus 3. I've seen minus 4s. By the way, the lower the number, the brighter the object for the magnitude scale. So minus 4 is a great pass for a space station. And this one's got to come in at minus 8. So we'll see. That's thoughts on the 23rd. Again, that will probably be in the western sky. The first one they said came from the Oort cloud. The
turbulent cloud surrounds the Earth. You have the Kuiper Belt, which also surrounds Kuiper Belt surrounds the Sun on the ecliptic plane. The Oort cloud, no matter where you are on Earth, you look up, it could be north, south of us. It could be the ecliptic plane. It doesn't matter. It's a sphere around the solar system. And that's called the Oort cloud. And they figured out that this comet takes about 80,000 years to orbit the Sun. So if we're here about another 80,000 years from now, we'll see it come back. Any comments? This is WS2N. Okay, one more visual appearance that appeared in the sky last Thursday was the aurora. This thing was incredible. You know, I'm on Long Island, I'm out in Suffolk County, and you know, you look up in the air, and you know, if you look to the west, you look to the east, you look to the north, not so much in the south, but you know, basically in a northerly direction. But it seemed to be all around me. It was the aurora, red and pink. I mean, really bright. So first time I had a chance to really see it, you know, you can go up to, the northern states or, you know, Alaska or something, and, you have a good chance of seeing it, usually like in the wintertime is okay in the summertime, but, you know, naturally after dark. But it was very, very bright. You had the highest index is, you know, they call it the K index. That they go up to is a 9. They said this one was 8.5 on the K index scale. It was pretty impressive. So much so I took a whole bunch of pictures, and I put one of them, Roy was good enough to put it on his website so you could see what it looks like from my house. If you go to roy.ac2gs.com and just scroll down a little bit, and you'll see the picture that he posted, and it was just taken with a cell phone, nothing fancy, you know, regular Android phone. I know a couple of people that have the iPhones, and I don't know, it came out even. I think it has an effect on the color, this color scheme, that it brings it out even brighter for some reason on these iPhones. But more realistic, I noticed, was on the Android phone. I mean, when I looked up, that's what I saw. So if you were lucky enough to come out and see that, it was really very good. Last couple of hours, roughly from, like 7 to 8, It was the best time I was out there. It was 7:30. That's when that picture was taken. And hope to see it again, but they said it's once in a lifetime, so I guess I used up my lifetime for that one. Any comments?
$80,000
in 80,000 years when it comes back, WB2 begets,
so.
I'll try, Frank. I'll try. If you promise to be there, I will do the same. Very good. And I will be getting to the Starship topic in a few seconds, but we're going to cover that. Did you see that, by the way? Did you happen to watch that this morning? Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, absolutely. I woke up like 6:30 to use the facilities and saw on my phone NSF Live Starship launch. So I put it on with the volume off and dozed until, I guess it was around 8 something when they said, 3 minutes to launch, and then I went inside and passed it to one of our big TVs. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely incredible. Elon Musk on this thing and left them up there, but otherwise, great show. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, that's going to be a game changer. Absolutely. Yeah, we might as well cover that now. Nobody saw this thing. By the way, it was not on the three news stations I usually watch. They usually cover, not every launch, but they'll cover an important launch. Well, this is one of them. What we're talking about is Starship, built by SpaceX. It was their fifth test flight. It flew out of Boca Chica, Texas. It was supposed to go off at 7 o'clock central, so 8 o'clock our time. There was a slight delay. They had a window only of a half hour, so it went off at 8:27, 3 minutes. They had 3 minutes left in that window. But all 33 Raptor engines fired and stayed lit. The booster and the Starship, which was on top, took off. Got up to near space. Separation took place, and then of course it keeps coasting up, and the booster actually winds up in space. Starship lit off its six engines, Starship regular Raptor engines, and another three Raptor vacuum equipped engines that they all lit off, and that thing could go off on its way to really a suborbital flight. Could have made orbit, but that's not the plan yet. The plan was to land in the Indian Ocean. But the main purpose of this whole flight was to see if they could return this booster, not to a drone ship like the Falcon 9s do, but all the way back to where it launched from the launch pad itself, and see if they could do that. Let me drop it. With that, after it separated from Starship, the big booster, which is like a 27-story building, 27 feet in diameter, did a 180. You know, it has these nitrogen jets on board, and it forces itself, it makes a turn, it's officially in space, so no problem, no atmosphere. So the little nitrogen jets fire, and it made a 180, and then they did a boost back burn. All the engines come on, forcing it in the direction of Boca Chica, Texas again. And after a while, the whole flight from launch until landing is almost 7 minutes. And you see this thing come through the atmosphere. They have a beautiful, beautiful clear day in Boca Chica, Texas. One reporter said it's the best launched weather they've had so far out of all their five launches. So, it came through through the atmosphere. They have a little graphic. You can see, if the engines are lit. Sure enough, 13 engines lit to slow it down as it's coming through the atmosphere. And then as it gets very close down, the only engines that are lit are just the center three engines. Three out of 33. Came right near the launch complex and vertically came down as slow as could be. It's got these big gigantic titanium wings, let's call them wings, sticking out. That helps it fly through the atmosphere. They're sticking out, and they have these big two big arms on this launch complex. So as it comes down, the arms start to close in. It came down very softly. You saw no vibration whatsoever. This thing caught support this booster weighing, empty its weight, 600,000 pounds. You know, when it takes off and it's fueled, you know, with liquid methane and liquid oxygen, it takes off, it's a million pounds of for the booster itself, it's over 7 million pounds. That fuel is pretty much used up, and you'll wind up with a weight of a little over 600,000 pounds being caught by the, they call it, they nickname these things the chopsticks, and they close in, and caught this thing in midair. So I haven't seen if a crew has gone out there yet to investigate, but we'll see what happens with that. Now that wasn't all, you know, it wasn't over, and I was only the first 7 minutes, which was, to me, that's a game changer. Right then and there, you'll be able to reuse these boosters as they're able to catch these things. And by the way, this is the first try. Usually, SpaceX does something when they try the first try, so a lot of times they have some problems. This went perfectly. The Starship kept going on all the way to a high altitude. I think it was around 250 kilometers, and then it starts coming back down again. It was a suborbital path. It was still going fast. It was going 24,000 kilometers an hour. And as it started to come down, it starts to heat up when it gets to around, I think it was around 100 kilometers, you know, around 60 miles above the surface of the Earth. You could start to see a little glowing on a Starship. And again, the goal with this whole program is to eventually catch the Starship too, but for now they're not doing that. They were just hoping to see if they could come down at a certain point in the Indian Ocean, right off the coast of Australia. And sure enough, it came through the atmosphere. It does this belly flop, they call it. You know, they're using it. They have these winglets sticking out, which helps slow it down. They're able to maneuver using the wings. The wings are maneuverable. They have them hooked up to these powerful electric motors. And sure enough, it got down near the ocean, in the Indian Ocean. And it went vertical. And if it was coming down on land, it would have made it. It came down very slow. And they had video of the landing, because they knew where it was going to come down exactly in the ocean. So they put a buoy out there with a camera on it. And, you know, by the way, of course, it's nighttime there, you know, like a 12-hour difference, you know. Launch in the morning here, it's landing near Australia at the time. So it was nighttime when it came down, and they said that went perfectly. So we'll see. We'll see what the number six flight does. He had good pictures coming all the way through the atmosphere. What they were doing is they were sending signals up from the TV cameras on Starship. Usually you have a blackout period, you know, 6-7 minutes of blackout with the high plasma surrounding a vehicle coming through the atmosphere. And they always lose, you know, audio and pictures. But not SpaceX, because there's Starlink satellites all over the globe right now. They have, what, I think 6,000 of them now. So the signal goes, in this case, going straight up, hitting a Starlink satellite overhead, and in turn, you know, it's acting as a repeater, and we got to see pictures, you know, all the way down through the atmosphere. Pretty impressive. Any comments? I'll stand by in case Frank wants to say something. I know he's on echo. WS2N.
Yeah, that was incredible. Anyway, I got to get going, but good description of what happened. And yeah, the TV networks didn't pick up on it. It's this is probably you know, one of the significant, most significant things that's happened in aerospace in many, many years. But, you know, it's interesting. I had looked up, as helping a friend with a term paper many years ago on the Wright brothers. I looked up the New York Times write-up of the Wright brothers' first flight, and it was buried on an interior page. It was just one or two paragraphs. And it's probably searchable online then. I had to get it on microfilm for a friend years ago. The New York Times did not think that was significant, and I think this is a very similar phenomenon. Anyway, I got to get going. I'll be back in maybe back before the net closes. WB2BXO.
Okay, Frank. Very good. Thanks for being there. And that is a game changer. What I like about it is other companies that are working on reusability, they'll be more motivated to, you know, keep doing what they're doing, because you know that now they've got to compete against this. You know, a lot of them have smaller vehicles, but they want them to be reusable. You know, they launch small payloads, and you know. I like the pictures. Companies like Firefly and Relativity. Another one, Blue Origin, with New Glenn. And you know, these are all companies that have reusability in mind. Even the Vulcan rocket by United Launch Alliance and Lockheed. They plan on it. They feel the booster itself isn't worth all that much, but the engines are. So they have plans of eventually just recovering the engines from that. We'll see. It's going to be exciting times with all these launches. You know, not to mention the European Space Agency launches. And countless launches from China, and India is now involved. They have a manned flight that they plan within a year or so on four, you know, one of their rockets. You know, they've got the capsule built and everything. It's going to be a three-man capsule. So we'll see. We'll try to cover all of these different topics on the net. Any comments? This is WS2N. Okay, nothing heard. New Shepard was supposed to go up today, actually at the same time that the Starship was going to go up. They were also going to launch from Texas, about 700 miles away, the other end of Texas, in Van Horn, Texas. Naturally, SpaceX is on it. He's on the East Coast with the launches, but Blue Origin with the New Shepard, the suborbital spacecraft, is in West Texas, and they were supposed to launch uncrewed, because the idea of this number 20, well, 27, NG-27, because that's their 27th flight, but it's brand new booster, brand new capsule. They made some improvements. It's human rated, but they wanted to launch it today to make sure everything's okay, you know, as a test. But they have 12 different payloads on board. You know, some of them are from NASA, and you know, they test suborbital flights all the time, and that's one of the things that Blue Origin is into. Within, I guess, a couple of more flights, this one will be ready to start launching crews. Then they'll have two vehicles. Right now they have the one booster, one space spacecraft that can launch six people at a time. You know, once this thing is approved, there'll be another six. They'll be able to increase their cadence. They'll be able to double that. So we'll see how that goes. They run a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. They call them B-3 engines. B-3 engine that puts out around 140,000 pounds of thrust. So it's just one engine. Takes them up to the Kármán line, which is 100 kilometers up, a little over 60 miles high. It separates from the spacecraft. The booster comes back down, 100% reusable, and that comes back, lands back, roughly where it launched from. And the capsule continues on, three parachutes, and it comes down and lands roughly, 15-18 minute flights. And we'll see more of that in the future. So I don't know when that flight is going to be. They delayed it today because they had a GPS problem. It's supposed to go off today. Some kind of computer related problem with the GPS. So once they straighten that out, they'll launch again. Any comments? Have Charlie here today. I know he'd be asking questions, but I heard he'll be back in a couple of weeks, not next week, but the following week. The HERA was launched successfully by a Falcon 9 right before the hurricane. I think I was going to cover that last week, and Hurricane Milton came through. And before that hurricane came through, they wanted to get this thing off the ground. This is the one that's going up to the double asteroid. Talked about that last week. So we'll have to wait a couple of years before it gets to the double asteroid. The spacecraft itself is designed and built by the European Space Agency. It's all kinds of cameras on board and instruments. And it's going to take pictures of that asteroid that we smashed spacecraft into a couple of years ago, and it's going to look at the end results. So that should be pretty good. I'm going to check on the orbit of it, around the other asteroid, and some other parameters, and get very good close pictures. I mean, it's going to get within a couple of yards of the asteroid. It'll be actually in orbit around the asteroid. And at a certain point, it's going to have two CubeSats, two small satellites that are going to separate from the mothership. And one is supposed to land on one asteroid, the other one's going to land on the other asteroid. And we'll see how that goes. And then after all of that, they plan on taking the biggest ship and eventually landing that on one of the asteroids as well. And that's where they'll stay till the end of time. Although I guess in the future you could send a spacecraft up to retrieve these things. It's in orbit around the sun. I think it orbits the sun every 8 years or so. So we'll see. Any other comments for the net? This is WS2N. Waiting to hear what happened with the Vulcan rocket, what the verdict is on that, that successfully launched a couple of weeks ago on its second mission, built by ULA, which is Boeing and Lockheed, a combination of both, and it was their second successful flight, except that one of the boosters, they have solid boosters, two of them on this rocket. They could put up to six if they wanted, but this one had two. The last one that went up beginning of the year, also had two boosters. This one, the starboard booster, had a failure with the nozzle, just the nozzle piece broke off, came flying back to landed in the water. You know, I did see video of that. They had a close-up shot, and you could see it definitely was a nozzle. And they have to figure out why that separated. The idea of Vulcan is they're trying to get it certified for many flights. They have like 80 flights on the manifest for the government, for Kuiper satellite, broadband satellite missions, and they need to get going. And get the okay, that they can figure out what this minor glitch was with just the nozzle of the booster. Once they get the, figure out what went wrong with that and submit papers to the government, I'm sure they'll probably get a certification. I don't think they'll have to launch another Vulcan to qualify. Hope not, anyway. We'll see. Any comments? This is WS2N. Okay, I don't have any other topics for now. We'll cover these topics and more next week. We'll see what's coming up. If there's any other exciting flights. One's supposed to be coming up. It was supposed to go up the 13th. But because of that Hurricane Milton, that thing didn't go. That was going to also go up on a SpaceX rocket. SpaceX Heavy. That's three rockets put together. And that's the Europa Clipper mission. That means it's going off to orbit Jupiter. And should get there by the end of the decade. It looks like it should go into orbit 2030. And that's the one that will, every time it goes around Jupiter, it will be passing very close to Europa. And they plan on around 40 orbits, which is going to take quite a few years to do, but around 40 orbits, every time they go near Europa, they'll take pictures. All kinds of instruments. They've got two big antennas, two HF antennas. I think it's around 80 meters. Going to send signals down through the ice, find out how thick the ice is, find out how thick the water is, do the math to figure out how much water is in this moon. It's already estimated that it's probably got twice the amount of water that we have on all of Earth. In other words, the water goes down quite a few miles and, below the crust. They've got this frozen ice crust completely covering the moon of Europa. So we'll see. Looking forward to, I guess, 6 years from now. Going to rush my life away. Any other comments before we turn it over to Roy? This is WS2N. Nothing heard. Thank everybody that listened and participated, and hope we can do the same next week. We're always here at the tail end of the TechNet to do the Space Net report. For now, let me turn it over to Roy, AC2GS, this is WS2N. Back to you, Roy.
Yep, this is AC2GS. Our rebels now are done. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. I hope you enjoyed yourself. I hope you learned something. I hope you come back next Sunday. So So as per usual, I'll remind you what Dick, K2RIW, always ended his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other. And I'll add good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas, but don't open them wide enough that your brain falls out. Everyone, have a great week. For those people who are observing it, have a good sukkah. Be well, stay safe, come back. And as always, I will close and be clear, AC2GS, after I say, Slava Ukraini.